You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Molly Stentz in for Rob Ferret. Now, this week, Michael Gabelman and Ravin Vass signed a new contract. The former state Supreme Court justice and the assembly speaker who hired him agreed to extend the taxpayer-funded contract for an ongoing investigation into the 2020 election in Wisconsin. Gabelman's investigation has been paused while several lawsuits relating to it move through the justice system. And we would love to hear from you. Have you heard much about this investigation? Gabelman has previously said it provides reasons for decertifying the 2020 election results here in Wisconsin, something that election experts and Ravin Vass himself have said is legally impossible. Perhaps you're tired about hearing about this. How do you think it ends? We'd love to hear from you. We're at 1-800-642-1234. You can always post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. You can email us at ideas@WPR.org or tweet us at @CentralTimeWPR. With us now is Sean Johnson, WPR's Capital Bureau Chief. Sean, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, Molly.
Hey, Sean. So why did Michael Gabelman need a new contract?
I mean, the shortest answer is that he was working without one there for a while, and it's not the first period of time where he has been without a contract since he was hired by the State Assembly and by Ravin Vass to oversee this election investigation as their special counsel. But that absence of a contract, the periodic absence of a contract, had become an issue off and on in some of the cases where Michael Gabelman is either a defendant or, you know, a plaintiff or kind of a tangential defendant. You know, there were questions by judges about what his formal relationship was. And so this formalizes that. And he is definitely, according to this document, working for the assembly now still as a special counsel. And, you know, this is also, there's been this question about whether or not Speaker Vass might say, you know, we're done with you, Michael Gabelman. Your investigation's over. Time to move on. Every time that seems like it might be a possibility, you'll see former President Donald Trump himself issue a statement coming out strongly in favor of Michael Gabelman and urging Vass to stand by him. So, you know, the question of whether and how long Mike Gabelman is working for the assembly has been an ongoing one, and it is going to be an ongoing one now for who knows how long.
Yeah. So there's no expiration date on this contract.
Yeah. The way that the contract is worded, it's set to terminate upon conclusion of all outside lawsuits involving the investigation. So what might that mean? There are a couple cases where there's a hearing in one of the open records cases for June 10th. There's a hearing in this really big subpoena case that Gabelman has brought against the mayors of Madison, Green Bay, and Racine, among other elections officials, where he's threatening to jail them if they don't comply with subpoenas to sit for private interviews. That case doesn't have a hearing scheduled until July 11th. It's already been delayed a few times as, you know, what Mike Gabelman is seeking has changed. And those are just hearing dates. You know, it's not saying there's going to be a decision by a certain date. And you can imagine that a decision might be appealed. So we really don't know how long these things could stretch on if they have this sort of indefinite nature to, you know, the word in the contract and, you know, and the cases.
Yeah. And so what do we know about what Gabelman has been working on recently?
I would say we don't know too much about what he's been working on since he issued his, you know, I think he called it an interim report back in March. It was initially billed as a final report from Speaker Vass. That is not how Michael Gabelman billed it when he presented it to members of the Assembly's Elections Committee. And, you know, in that committee, he, I would say, largely talked about Elections Commission policies when it came to running the election. And he did highlight some specific instances where elderly voters voted in the 2020 election, and played video for members of the committee where these voters were interviewed by a private attorney and the voters appeared confused. This is the hearing, the report where he suggested that lawmakers take a hard look at decertifying the election, something that the legislature's nonpartisan attorneys have said is not possible, something that Mike Gableman's own attorney in one of these cases has said is not possible, and, you know, something that's not going anywhere. You haven't heard Republicans say, let's move forward with this. Speaker Voss has taken some heat in the base for saying you can't do it. So your question is, what's happened since then? Yeah. We don't really know. I mean, that was where Gableman kind of made a big splash. What's happened since then is he has kind of been a presence among the group of Trump supporters who, you know, are election conspiracists and has traveled the country, spoken, you know, to Trump himself, has become a name in conservative circles, if he wasn't already. I don't know what he's done beyond that, in terms of the investigation. He hasn't issued another report since then.
But he's still got this contract with the state being paid.
He has a contract now for being paid $5,500 a month, down from $11,000 a month. And the contract also calls for paying $2,100 a month to cover his rent at an office where he's renting space. So it's down from what he was paying before, being paid before, but he is, you know, he's on the payroll, and we don't know exactly how much the lawsuits connected to this investigation are going to end up costing. You know, the speaker, the contract, the initial contract with Gableman called for $676,000 for this investigation, but you know, the Gableman has been involved in a lot of court cases, you know, the one of which he's brought himself. And so these have gotten expensive, and we don't know the extent of what that billing is going to cost.
Yeah. Well, we've got some calls coming in for you, Sean. Let's go next to Madison, where we have Scott on the line. Hi, Scott. What's your question?
My question is, when is somebody going to step in and arrest all of the people involved in this fraud? There is quite obviously nothing found, and all they do is continue to spend money and spin lies.
Okay, Scott, it's a little hard to hear you, but I heard you asking about fraud and with regard to this investigation, in that there has been little documented evidence produced out of this investigation regarding election security and election fraud.
Yeah, and I also was having a little bit of a hard time hearing, and so it's kind of a critical question, though. Scott was alluding to arrests there, and, you know, I can say that the actual instances of voter fraud, you know, we know are very rare in Wisconsin. There have been some charges this year, but it's in line. The charges connected to the 2020 election are in line with what we've seen in previous elections. And voter fraud itself is not specifically alleged in Gableman's report. It alludes to sort of an illegal administration of the election. It alleges this in the way that the Elections Commission and others administered the election. It does not, it's not like a list of alleged fraud.
Yeah. Well, you know, one thing on my mind is that the midterm campaign season is heating up. We've got the primary coming up in August. We see candidates for governor staking claims here about the election. How big a factor do you think this is going to be?
It's definitely a factor for the Republican base. I mean, Speaker Voss announced the hiring of Michael Gableman at the Republican State Convention last year. the Republican state convention this year is coming right up, and you have an active primary for governor right now. And none of the candidates at this point have been endorsed by former President Donald Trump. That endorsement would be huge in a competitive primary like Wisconsin's. What's the singular issue that Donald Trump is concerned with in his public statements? He talks about the election nonstop and Wisconsin's election nonstop. He falsely asserts that he lost, or that, sorry, he falsely asserts that he won.
He won.
And and so he wants a candidate who will say that. He wants a candidate who will say, I want to fight to overturn that erase. And he also wants to get a candidate, though, that, you know, he thinks can win the election, because that's important to buttressing his, you know, political strength as he weighs a 2024 run for president. So the reason the election issue is such an issue will continue to be an issue among, you know, candidates running for higher office is because the former president wants it to be, and the GOP base is not ready to stop talking about it either.
Well, we will continue to follow this and look to your reporting. Sean Johnson, WPR Capitol Bureau Chief. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Molly.
We've been talking about updates on former state Supreme Court Justice Michael Gabelman's investigation of the 2020 election. Next, we're going to hear from a Wisconsin elections researcher who says the investigation is a waste of taxpayers' money and dangerous for future state elections. We'll continue this conversation in just a bit here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Molly Stentz in for Rob Ferret. We'll continue talking about the ongoing investigation into the 2020 election in Wisconsin being led by former state Supreme Court Justice Michael Gabelman. Assembly Speaker Robin Voss just inked a new contract with Gabelman, extending his investigation with no expiration date. Our next guest has a new opinion piece up online in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. It will be out in print this weekend. And he's calling for the investigation to end. Our guest is Barry Burden, professor of political science and director of the Elections Research Center at UW-Madison. Barry, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks, Molly. Glad to be here.
So, Barry, why do you think this investigation needs to be stopped?
Well, there are many reasons. I think it was going in the wrong direction from the outset. Gabelman, even before he was appointed to this role, expressed skepticism that Joe Biden had won the election fairly, and that seems to be a conclusion that he is trying to build evidence to support. His scope of the study has ranged from things like voting machines to voter rolls to elderly people being coerced, to grants being given to municipalities, drop boxes. So there's sort of a range of things that he is scouring, hoping, I think, to produce evidence for his conclusion. But really, the whole affair has been bumbling and incompetent. He said in a couple of interviews at the outset of the project that he didn't have an understanding of how elections work in Wisconsin. And I thought that was a shocking statement from a former Supreme Court justice who had actually ruled on election issues, including things like voter identification requirements, which were controversial and went to the state Supreme Court, redistricting cases that went to the state Supreme Court. And now I think the concern at the moment, which we express in this op-ed, is that he's continuing to pester election officials, especially in larger cities, who are in the midst of planning for the August 9th primary and the big November general elections, but are having to deal with subpoenas, requests for information, and demands being placed on them that are just unreasonable and distracting.
So why do you think it continues?
It's hard to say. I think Gabelman himself has suggested that he has a sincere belief that there were major problems with the election and he wants to uncover those. So far, he has not done that, in my opinion. He's issued a couple of reports and testified before the legislature. He's also traveled the country speaking at events. He went to Mar-a-Lago and other places. But most of those appearances are raising questions and suggesting things are out of line. There's a kind of, you know, connecting of the dots almost that suggest something's amiss, but has never quite proven it, and I think wants to do that. And I think he's also sort of bristled under the criticism that he's gotten from some fellow members of his party and from election professionals who are trying to do their jobs, and he really wants to prove himself right. So it's not about the money as much as people have raised concerns about his salary or the budget that's been given to his team. I think he would do this unpaid. I believe he even offered to do it for a dollar in the most recent contract negotiation. So it seems to be a kind of dogma on Gableman's part that he wants to bring to fruition.
What impact do you think it's having on the election system that we have, both the people working in it and then also voter trust in our elections?
Yeah, I think it's had really damaging effects in both of those areas. We know that some members of the electorate, especially supporters of Donald Trump, have suspicions or doubts about the 2020 election. Gableman has said that one of his purported goals is to address those criticisms and concerns, suspicions, but I think he's actually furthering them by raising questions and not answering them in a convincing fashion. And, you know, just the incompetence and rambling nature of his investigation is really making groups more suspicious. And he's actually speaking at their rallies and talking with election deniers and election skeptics who believe in the big lie. So it's having a counter effect in terms of public opinion. And then election officials who have really been under pressure and faced unbelievable stress in 2020, trying to run an election during a pandemic and while facing unprecedented levels of threats and personal harassment, are continuing to feel that. The pandemic situation may be better, but they are continuing to get hard criticism and in some cases, you know, personally threatening messages or harassing messages by people who have bought into Gableman's narrative. And they are trying to deal with all of the legal things that Gableman is throwing at them, threatening to jail them, demanding that they meet with him in secret to undergo depositions and those kinds of things. So it's a major distraction in a very busy election year when there have already been two elections this year and two more important ones yet to run.
Yeah, and that's what strikes me is that meanwhile, you know, elections happen, the system moves on, and we have had elections, and there have not been similar criticisms and calls of rigging the election here in Wisconsin in the spring election.
It's true. I haven't heard any major concerns about the February or April elections that happened across the state. And actually, in Gableman's investigation of the November 2020 election, he has focused on the presidential race only, which was at the top of the ticket, but not the many other races that were also on the ballot, including members of Congress, most of the state legislature. In his last presentation to the state legislature and in his report that Sean mentioned, he suggested that the presidential election results might be decertified. He says the evidence points in a direction that would support that. But if he thought the election was really fraudulent and failed, wouldn't he also want to decertify all of the other elections down the ballot? He has not proposed that. So the logic doesn't fit and isn't supported really by any convincing evidence.
I mean, have you seen evidence that this is impacting public faith in elections? I mean, I'm thinking about the latest Marquette poll that showed the vast majority of Wisconsinites do have faith in their elections and the electoral system.
Yeah, that's an important message for us to remember. Most of the public is pretty confident about the election. They heard the messages that it was secure and proper and picked the right winner. Doesn't mean that it was a perfect election. I think there are things that ought to be tweaked, especially in an election with an unprecedented amount of absentee voting during a pandemic with some new practices in place. But most of the public feels comfortable with what has been done. But I think the Gableman investigation is continuing to raise doubts among that segment of the public that had doubts right after Election Day when all of those lawsuits were being filed and there were questions about the electors and the Electoral College. Normally, those kinds of concerns, especially from people who voted for the losing candidate, you know, people have sour grapes for a while and then they tend to fade. But after 2020, they have not faded. And this investigation is keeping them alive at a time when really the public and election professionals need to turn their attention to the next round of elections.
Yeah. And are you watching other states in addition to Wisconsin and these election investigations?
I am. It's unfortunate that a network has developed of election skeptics in key swing states around the country, and they are in communication with one another and coordinating with one another. Some listeners may have heard about the review that happened in Arizona, in Maricopa County, after the election there. Arizona was also a swing state. A private group called the Cyber Ninjas were tasked with a big investigation, review, audit, whatever you'd like to call it, lasted many months, took many millions of dollars, and produced essentially nothing credible at the end of the day, a big report and lots of questions. But they ended up inviting in legislators from Wisconsin who came to visit. Michael Gableman apparently traveled to Arizona to visit. He's been to other seminars, including people like the MyPillow CEO, Mike Lindell, who is part of the election skeptic community. So they're reinforcing one another's doubts about the election by communicating across state lines.
So what are you, as we wrap up, what are you watching now on this front?
Well, I want to make sure that people who are running elections, are nearly 2,000 clerks who serve every municipality and county around the state, stay in their jobs and are willing to stick it out even in these difficult times. It's a difficult job. You know, many of them serve part-time and have other things to do and are just facing criticism and demands and threats against them, including you know, threats that they be jailed.
Yeah.
We need to protect them.
We will keep an eye on it. Thank you, Barry, for joining us today.
Glad to be with you. Thanks again.
Barry Burden is a professor of political science and director of the Elections Research Center at the UW-Madison. We've been speaking about the election investigation by Michael Gableman and Barry's piece in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel that will be out on newsstands later this weekend, and it's up online right now. Coming up after the news, Americans have a lot of stuff, and it can be easy to feel buried in clutter. We'll talk with the author of a book about how things pile up and what to do about it. I'm Molly Stenz, in for Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Molly Stenz, in for Rob Ferret. Thanks for joining us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we're talking about your favorite spring produce. This warm week should bring out more spring veggies soon. We've got a chef and food writer with some recipes for us. Now, clutter is big business in the United States. There are services to help us clean up and get organized or deal with all of our possessions after we leave them behind. And it's big in pop culture. Shows like Tidying Up with Marie Kondo make the case for getting rid of things that don't spark joy. Shows like Hoarders look at clutter when it's taken to the extreme. But all of those shows deal with clutter that we already have. Today we're listening back to a conversation with a guest who says we need to look at the causes of clutter and what leads us to get so many things in the first place. What's your experience with clutter? Have you found a way to cut down on all that stuff you have lying around? How did you decide what to keep and what to get rid of? You can email us at ideas@wpr.org or tweet us at @CentralTimeWPR. Jennifer Howard is a Washington, D.C.-based writer and editor. Her latest book is called Clutter, An Untidy History. She spoke with Rob Ferret earlier this year.
Well, you open the book with a story about your mother and going through her home and her stuff. Can you talk about what you went through and why that inspired you to seek out more of the history of clutter?
Sure. Well, like a lot of us, I found myself actually very suddenly in the position of having to clean out my mother's house after she had a mental and physical breakdown. It really was, she went from overnight living in her house that she'd been in for 50 years to not being able to be there at all. It just wasn't safe. So it felt to me as an only child to go in and try to make some sense of everything that she had. You know, I had to deal with her papers, her finances, all the medical care, but then I had this house full of stuff. And I was shocked and overwhelmed by how much stuff my mother had managed to accumulate in all that time. I knew she was not a minimalist, but I didn't realize, until I actually had to deal with everything in there, just how much she had. And that got me interested sort of as a survival mechanism to try in trying to understand what was happening and how my mother, and as it turns out, so many other people, wound up in this really, really difficult situation.
And you dug back into history and you find we're not alone in the United States with clutter and having lots of stuff. But you kind of trace the history here in the U.S. back to Victorian England when we start to have a different relationship with being able to buy lots of stuff and wanting lots of things. What kind of things did you find out?
Oh, it was fascinating. I could have written multiple books on the Victorians alone. I was hoping I could find a starting point for clutter, like the historical moment when clutter was born. And I couldn't really trace the moment, but there was so much in the Victorian era that resonated for me as a 21st century American, the kind of love of things and the love of having nicely furnished houses and all the stuff we can buy and the message that we get to, you know, that we should be buying things, should be buying more. The Victorians would have been very familiar with all of that. When you look at the Industrial Revolution and, you know, the ability to make more things more quickly and ship them to people, with the rise of cities, with department stores, all these things kind of started to coalesce as I was reading and looking around for me in the Victorian era. And you think about the Crystal Palace, the famous glass, huge glass showcase, basically, of the London Exhibition in 1851. It kind of that really became a touchstone for me for this modern phenomenon of clutter. And I really felt it was very, very much an important starting point for that.
I mentioned earlier the TV show Hoarders. There are others that look at, you know, when collecting stuff really goes to an extreme. A big point in your book, though, is those shows sometimes treat the hoarder as this sort of individual pathology. You kind of see it, correct me if I'm wrong, you see it as a symptom of a wider attitude toward consumerism and our desire to have and keep stuff.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, of course, personal choice and personal habits and sometimes mental challenges can really contribute to this problem. But, you know, from the minute we're born, we are steeped in this culture of buy, buy, buy. I mean, think about if you've ever been to a baby shower or anything, really anything you do in modern life often it seems to involve the message that you should buy something. And that's what you should be doing as a good consumer and all that. And it's very hard for individuals to escape the power of that message. As I said, it starts when we're kids, and we're surrounded by advertising and by big box stores and now online, you know, e-commerce, Amazon. It's so easy to buy, and as I saw with my mother, I think she got trapped in this web of consumerism, and once you're stuck in it, it can be very, very hard for people to get out of it just through force of individual will alone.
Talking to Jennifer Howard about her book, Clutter, An Untidy History. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you feel like there's a lot of clutter in your life? What leads you to buy stuff, bring you into your home? What challenges do you have when it comes to getting rid of stuff? Do you know someone who you've seen it go pretty far with bordering on hoarding things? What changed? Was there something that made them change their ways? Call in with your thoughts, experiences, and questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Jennifer, you just mentioned sort of the emotional connection we have with things, and I'm not a hoarder. I kind of go back and forth. I just purged a bunch of kids' drawings from their little, and I go back and forth between, there's a smudge on this paper that a kid might have made, got to keep it forever, to this ruthless paring down. But I get the emotional investment in a thing. There's a memory connected with why we have it in the first place that I can understand people being reluctant to let go of. Talk about the emotions at the center of this.
Oh, that's really at the heart of it. That is what makes it, I think, so hard for so many of us to get rid of things, because we do have personal connections. And, you know, if grandma gave you something, mm-hmm. or the little thing you brought back from the sea, you know, your beach trip with the kids, and you feel like you're throwing away the vacation if you throw away the object. It's really hard. And if every object or many of them have that kind of some kind of emotional baggage with them, no wonder it's hard to get rid of them. If you have to stop and process all those feelings, those memories, it's overwhelming. And it's easy, again, since we are so, you know, a society that really does value things, we sometimes conflate the thing with the person or the memory, and it's very hard to kind of extricate yourself from that. The kids' artwork, all, you know, everything your child ever touched is valuable or feels like it, but it's hard to actually sort of get yourself to do the process of sorting and deciding what's really important, what's enough, and what's too much.
A lot of our efforts, and a lot, I think, businesses make money off of this, they go toward the back end. We have the clutter. We have the stuff. How do we organize it? How do we sort it? How do we purge it? Whatever. What kind of things are you thinking about when it comes to the front end, whether we bring a thing into our house in the first place and how we curate it before it becomes cluttered in the first place?
That's the thing. If you can head it off at the pass, that's the way to go. It's very hard because you know, we're in a society that gives us freebies and sends, you know, everything comes in a bag and a package, and you go to if you go out to a hotel, you come home with all these little shampoos and conditioners. You know, it's free. Why not? Maybe it'll be useful. And it's so, but you really have to take that early step of saying, do I really want this? Do I really need it? You know, is it just gonna take up space in my medicine cabinet or my closet or my kitchen cupboard? All those sauce packets that you get if you get takeout, you know, takeout food. And when you start looking for opportunities to say no to things, you realize there are a lot of them, and it doesn't seem like it would make that much of a difference, but over time it really does, and it's, you know, saves you time, saves you the energy of having to try to figure out what you're going to do with it down the road. Bigger purchases too. Do you really need more clothes? You know, shop your closet first. There are things you can do that really will help address the clutter problem and be more economical and also just better for the environment and society in general.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Lisa is with us in Wazaki. Lisa, hi.
Hi. I am an artist. My husband sort of considers me a hoarder. I mean, he can get through my house and my dishes are clean, but I paint and I quilt and I draw and I sew and I have canning stuff and I've got stuff. I've probably got 5-6 times what the average person has, but it's because I do all of these things. I have trouble finding homes for things, you know, permanent places to put them, and I have difficulty with storage. But if, you know, and but I worry, I'm getting a little bit older, and I worry about something happening to me, and then what's whoever's left taking care of it going to do with all of it?
Have you thought, Lisa, or have you looked for ways to curate a purge? I know it might be hard, but deciding that some stuff has to go even if it doesn't find a home?
Yes, I've actually pared down some of the things that I've done. Like, for instance, I can do probably 100 different crafts, but I've decided that, you know, maybe 5 of them are what I'm really interested in, and I've tried to let the rest of it go. But I have to bring myself back to that regularly because my set point is to try to do everything.
Lisa, thank you so much for sharing your story. And Jennifer, that reminds me, this is the thing where somebody we might look at and say is a hoarder, which we'll talk about that word in a bit, but also they might be an artist. There's a lot more to their story than that, as we just heard from Lisa.
Sure, absolutely. No, that really resonates with me. And, you know, if you're using your things and appreciating them, they're not really clutter, I don't think. I mean, clutter is chaotic, it's messy, it's kind of deprives the, it makes the things not really useful in the way they are. And it sounds like someone like Lisa, who's actively creating and using things, you know, maybe there's sort of a, she can sort of think of her excess as, there might be other people out there who could use things, or she could kind of help circulate things. I don't know. I think there are some ways to make it less, make the amount of stuff seem less overwhelming. And if you're thinking about it in the first place, that's huge. That is, I think it really sets someone who can handle their stuff apart from people who are just lost entirely in all their stuff.
Lisa, thank you so much for sharing your story. We're talking to writer Jennifer Howard about her book, Clutter, An Untidy History. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. If you have a story about clutter in your life, your relationship with your stuff, your kids' stuff, your parents' stuff, maybe, call in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with writer and editor Jennifer Howard about her book, Clutter, An Untidy History. Let's go back to your calls now at 800-642-1234 with Marcus on the line in Milwaukee. Hi, Marcus.
Hi, Rob. So my great aunt and uncle used to have a little wooden plaque in their house that said creative clutter is far superior to idle neatness, and I completely agree. As for like what the guest was talking about before with or you were saying with kids' pictures and stuff from the beach and whatever else, I like to do art in my free time. And so I started taking with my kids, we'll sit down and go through their pictures from school and whatever else. And then some of the stuff we may have picked up, rocks or shells or whatever at the beach. And then we try to either get a board or a shoebox or something, make some sort of diorama or some sort of other creation out of pictures that they pick. So that way they're having to kind of choose and go through like why they like this one or why I like this one. And then we kind of create something new. So then you add an extra layer of memory on top of it. And it's a great way to use up some of that stuff.
Interesting, Marcus. Thanks so much. What it's kind of shopping at home, Jennifer, and creatively repurposing the stuff that's around instead of just, I guess, storing it somewhere.
Yeah, no, that's lovely. I mean, that really shows you that objects can have a meaningful role in your life. And, you know, there's active choice there too. And it gets, I love that Marcus is getting his children to think too about what matters to them and what they're, you know, that how they can kind of work their important things into their lives instead of just having stuff pile up around them and not be appreciated. I think that's great.
Marcus, thanks a lot for that. Could use that probably 15 years ago. We'll go next to Jamie in Middleton. Jamie, hi.
Hi, this is Jamie. I was just speaking to my parents are moving out of the house we grew up in, and so they've been there for 30 years, and their professions are a former art teacher and construction worker, and so with those careers come a lot of stuff. So we're finding it tough to get rid of and want to be mindful of how to recycle and not waste, but 30 years can be quite the accumulation.
Yeah. And now, Jamie, is there a sense that, hey, some of this stuff, I mean, construction worker, art teacher, they're going to have stuff that might be useful to somebody? Is that part of the stumbling block that they want to make sure they're not wasting something that somebody can make use of?
Yes. And obviously, it's a passion of both of theirs. And a lot of heart goes into the work. So you know what things are worth and all the different ideas you have with it. So yeah, definitely want to recycle and reuse and give it to someone else who might find use, but quite the process if it's not something you kind of keep up with and sort through as you go.
Jamie, thank you so much for sharing that. This is something, Jennifer, that a lot of people have been through, you to some extent with your mom's stuff. Like, some of this is going to end up in landfill, but maybe some of this has sentimental value for somebody. Waste not, want not. Maybe somebody could use this stuff. How much could that lead to keeping the clutter?
Well, I think that is a big part of it. People think, well, it's, you know, it's perfectly good. I don't want to throw it out, you know, it could be useful someday. And the truth is, most of the time, it's not going to be useful. And if you really need that thing, you can probably borrow it or get it again. But the idea is much easier to let go of things if you can rehome them and you know that they're going to be used. They're not going to wind up in a landfill, especially when, as Lisa was describing, there are things that, you know, have to do with how you spend a lot of your life, your career, your family. And it takes a lot of work to do that kind of the rehoming and donating. But if, especially living at a family house and try to help your parents deal with all of their things, it probably is worth the time if you can take the time, even though it is harder. You don't want to just pull up a dumpster and, you know, throw it all away. It's much easier to try to, ultimately it's more emotionally satisfying to let it go when you know it's going to have another life.
Thanks again for that call. Good luck to your parents as they make those decisions. We are talking to Jennifer Howard about her book, Clutter, An Untidy History. Back to your calls now. Dave is with us in Kewaskum. Dave, hi.
Hey, yeah, so like that caller Lisa before, my dad was an artist growing up, so he always collected a bunch of what people call junk, you know, plastic tubes, stuff like that. And they always sort of rode that line of being hoarders. And then one day, between health issues and they got hold of that Marie Kondo book, they just went through and threw out everything. And they were very satisfied. They're very happy with where they are right now. But in the process, they threw out a lot of, you know, family heirlooms and stuff that was significant to the family. And we never really got an opportunity to go through it with them and point out what we would like to keep. And that sort of left an open wound in the family.
Wow. Dave, thanks for sharing that. I mean, did you come to terms with that? Did you talk to them about that, find out other ways to keep memories without the object?
Not really. I mean, we managed to salvage some family photos, but that's still sort of an ongoing thing.
Wow. Dave, thank you for sharing that. Jennifer, maybe this is another extreme. I don't know. Some people did want the stuff that was gotten rid of here.
Oh, absolutely. And there's a balance, you know. I think, especially when you're, it's not just your stuff, but it's your family history, which, especially with a family house, you know, and your parents have, I just went through all my elementary school papers that my parents had saved. And, you know, at least I got to make the decisions about that and got to relive some of the highs and lows of my, you know, my childhood. And I regret, one thing I really regret with my mother is that I didn't have a chance to sit down and hear her stories about her stuff. You know, I was flying in the dark, basically, when it came to what was important to her or who this person in this photograph was. And it's a loss, you know, as the caller was just describing, it's almost like everything got taken away from you in a fire or a flood. You know, to have no say in how your what parts of your history you get to save. That's really traumatic. And ideally, if you have relatives who are downsizing, they will give you a chance to, you know, hear their stories and help you, or you maybe let you help them make some choices about what to say and what might be meaningful to future generations. Because once that stuff is gone, it's gone.
Thanks, Dave, for sharing that with us. Sherry joins us now in Amherst. Sherry, hi.
Hi. My husband and I taught internationally for 32 years. And we traveled, and everywhere we went, we'd collect things. And then we'd come home, and we'd store them away. And then we'd go to another location. And so now that we've retired, we've unpacked all this stuff. And we have a very cluttered house with stuff, beer steins, paintings from China, paper cuts, teapots, Saudi Arabian coffee pots, porcelain, and beer steins, and it goes on and on and on. And I'm trying to, and our children aren't interested. And so I'm trying to figure out where I could have these things settled, because it's not like something you would get at a thrift store, I don't think. Of course, my treasures. And so I would love to know where I could actually take some of the stuff, because some of it is antiquities.
Sherry, thanks for the call. And this has got to be a common question. I bet a lot of people bring it up to you, Jennifer. This stuff is too good to just give away, but I don't know what to do with it.
Oh, it's so common, especially as, you know, with a lot of family furniture and things like that. And it sounds like the caller has a lot of interesting stuff collected from around the world. I mean, honestly, it's good to be realistic about whether people really want to pay money for your things if you don't have family members who want them. A lot of people do have success with estate sales, and you don't have to die to have an estate sale. You can have a downsizing sale, and there are companies that will actually work with you, and they do take a percentage of the profits, but they can come in and they you know, kind of look at what you have and put prices on it and advertise the sale. That could be potentially a useful option in that case. But sometimes you just have to let it go too, and to know when it's too much effort to try to sell it, and it's better to just find it a new home.
Well, thanks for all of your calls today, and Jennifer, thanks again for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me on the show, and I loved all the calls. So many good stories.
That was Jennifer Howard, a Washington, D.C.-based writer and editor. She spoke with Rob Ferret earlier this year about her latest book called Clutter, An Untidy History. And if you have an experience to share about decluttering your own space or helping a loved one cut down on clutter, you can let us know by emailing ideas@WPR.org. Coming up after the news, asparagus. Is yours up yet? We want to hear about it. We've got recipes for radishes and more in this week's edition of Food Friday. You can get us started right now at 800-642-1234. What's your favorite spring produce? Have you made it to your local farmer's market yet? What do you love to make? Give us a call, 1-800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. I'm Molly Stentz, in for Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.